Hi, it's Diane. On my mind,
President Trump's former top advisor on Russia is testifying.
Lawmakers are set to hear from a former top aide, the Secretary of State Mike Pompeo.
Let's talk about Gordon Sondland. This is Trump's own advisor who's going to be testifying today.
A week of revelations in the impeachment inquiry. One by one, key witnesses marched to the Capitol and met with lawmakers behind closed doors. These current and former diplomats painted a picture of a shadow foreign policy with Ukraine, directed by the president's personal lawyer, Rudy Giuliani. Susan Glasser writes a weekly column for The New Yorker called Letter from Trump's Washington, and there was plenty to write about this week. Susan Glasser joined me in the studio. Susan Glasser, how great to see you again.
What a treat, Diane. Thank you.
Let's start. We've had closed-door hearings this week from several very important people. Talk first about Gordon Sondland.
He is a very interesting character in all of this. He is the current ambassador to the European Union. He's essentially a novice to both politics and international diplomacy in particular. He bought his way into an ambassadorship, which is an unusual but not uncommon aspect in both Democratic and Republican administrations. He didn't even like Donald Trump in 2016, but he gave $1 million to his inaugural committee. He became friends with Steve Mnuchin, the future Treasury Secretary, who got him this job. And he has been a very enthusiastic enlistee in Donald Trump's campaign against the European Union. You know, he has almost divined himself in opposition to the EU, America's closest partners on the world stage. And Sondland has been essentially this very China-breaking, undiplomatic envoy in Brussels, carrying out the Trumpian agenda. What we didn't know until recently is that he was also involved in Ukraine, which is not a member of the European Union and is hundreds of miles
involved
away.
In Ukraine.
And what I find so fascinating about this, because it takes this plot, if you will, right directly into the Oval Office, is that Donald Trump basically gave him this portfolio. And this is a testimony this week from someone else, from Fiona Hill, Trump's former NSC senior director. That's the person who normally would be in charge of our policy toward Russia and Ukraine. And she realizes that this EU ambassador is in all these meetings at the White House and is in the middle of this Ukraine policy and therefore Russia policy. She finally confronts him. He invites him to a meeting in her office, and she says, well, who gave you my portfolio? And he says, the president of the United States. So that's the context, long-windedly, for saying Gordon Sondland was both a participant in this plot of Trump's to use American leverage to get Ukraine to investigate Joe Biden and also the 2016 election. But Sondland also made an interesting decision to defy the administration and to testify. And in his written statement, he makes clear that he did not approve of Trump's privatizing foreign policy and forcing Sondland and other U.S. officials to go through Rudy Giuliani, a private attorney.
But do you believe that his testimony was CYA?
Well, aspects of it certainly were. For example, he goes, it's quite an interesting opening statement. It's 18 pages, but I recommend reading it through. It's a quick read, as they say. You know, so in aspects of it, he's sort of justifying why he was involved in Ukraine policy. He is trying to refute the idea that he was a hopeless novice who didn't know anything about it, which, of course, he was. And apparently in Fiona Hill's testimony, she also went on some length that he was so ignorant. She told the members of the impeachment inquiry he was so ignorant that he posed a counterintelligence risk to the United States simply because he could make such blunders on behalf of the U.S. But so, yes, this is self-justifying. But it's interesting when Trump's own officials start to point the finger at him, and his testimony definitely points the finger at Donald Trump and Rudy Giuliani.
What about Michael McKinley?
You know, Mike McKinley is a very interesting figure in this saga. He was a senior counselor to the Secretary of State, Mike Pompeo, until 1 week ago. And he is a career Foreign Service official. He has served for nearly 40 years on behalf of the United States. He has been an ambassador, I believe, four times to four different countries. And he chose to remain and not to quit in protest in the Trump administration, and actually rose to become a key confidant by all accounts of Pompeo, and serving as his envoy in a way to the rest of the State Department. So it's quite remarkable that he chose to quit. He says that he chose to quit in protest of Pompeo's failure to stick up for his career ambassador to Ukraine, who was fired by Donald Trump, and for other department officials as they've been politicizing the American diplomatic corps. And, you know, it's a very interesting story. We obviously don't know all the details yet. I'm very personally curious in that one because I spent some months looking into Pompeo for a big profile in The New Yorker. But again, it just speaks to the overall atmosphere of the deep politicization of American foreign policy.
Exactly.
And not only politicization, but not in service of, say, Republican policy ends, but in service of personal political ends.
What about the ambassador, or I should say the former ambassador to Ukraine, Marie Yovanovitch?
Right. So she, again, is a career professional. She is still employed by the State Department, as is Gordon Sondland, obviously, who is a political appointee, as is another person who testified this week, George Kent, the Deputy Assistant Secretary in charge of Ukraine policy. So Masha Yovanovitch and all these others defied the State Department and the White House in coming to testify. They can be fired for this, although in the end, they couldn't stop them from testifying. She was removed from her position this spring. Personally, it now turns out, by the President of the United States, after what appears to be baseless allegations that were spread against her by Rudy Giuliani and his mysterious shadowy henchmen from the former Soviet Union, Lev Parnas and Mr. Fruman, who were arrested at the airport a couple weeks ago.
So does the testimony of those four people, as some have said, break the dam?
Yes. You know, it's interesting. I think that certainly from a legal standpoint, I spoke with Fiona's lawyer, Lee Walowski, and he used that phrase. He said the floodgates have opened. He didn't necessarily mean that, you know, floodgates have opened in terms of every White House official will now be testifying against Trump, but they have breached the stonewall because the White House bluff was called. And essentially, they decided not to go to court. So Fiona was the first current or former White House official to testify on Monday. And, you know, he told me it was really dramatic that, you know, he didn't know up until the moment they showed up on the Hill whether the White House was going to go to court to try to stop them or not, because they were exchanging these legal letters. And the White House was asserting a very broad, essentially, not only executive privilege, but essentially saying, we won't allow you to testify because we don't agree in the legitimacy of the inquiry itself. Those are sweeping and scary words. Well, he wrote back to the lawyer, he said, well, A, we disagree with your legal interpretation, and B, we're planning to go there anyways. And so he basically called their bluff and he said, so if you don't like it, you know, you can go to court or otherwise you can't do anything.
And they didn't.
And they didn't. And so it's not like they can go to court now when John Bolton, if he shows up to testify, and what are they going to say?
So, did you see Mick Mulvaney yesterday?
What a moment that was, right? It was as unusual and remarkable a press conference as a White House official has ever given in my memory. He's the acting chief of staff, which even that I find to be so classically Trumpian, right? You know, it's just such an insult. The man has been doing this job since January, and he has not even been accorded the dignity of the title. And yet, no matter how much Trump abases these people, what I find so extraordinary is that they continue to allow themselves to be humiliated and, in fact, are willing to go out and do even more on Trump's behalf. You know, in many ways, they confirm the president's very cynical view of human nature. So Mulvaney, the acting chief of staff, gets up there. First, he announces, I think, one of the most remarkable decisions, even stipulating to the fact that we're filled with lots of remarkable developments. The president of the United States deciding to hold the G7 summit as his own resort is a mic drop of a scandal. It really, truly is. Often in Washington scandals, we talk about the appearance of a conflict of interest or the appearance of impropriety. this is just impropriety. This is actually the textbook definition of a conflict of interest. If it was any other U.S. government official, aside from the president or the vice president, who are exempt for very different reasons, there is, of course, a federal law that bars any government official from giving themselves a contract. This is the kind of offense that would get you not just fired from your federal job, but arrested. This is a felony.
He did, however, say that it would be at cost and that, therefore, President Trump would not be making a profit.
Right. You know, I'm not a lawyer, but I think if you ask any lawyer, they would tell you that that's a ridiculous argument. And in fact, it is a gross abuse of power.
And Mick also said that it was the best place in the country.
Yes, he did. You know, it's funny. We're a big country, Diane. You and I have both been to a lot of hotels. You know, in fact, it's the one place in the country where anyone who hasn't completely lost their moral compass knows you shouldn't have this event no matter what. Period. Full stop. Ain't difficult.
So, tell us.
Not partisan, by the way.
Not
partisan. How could
partisan.
That possibly be a partisan argument?
What about Mick Mulvaney saying to the press sitting there, get over it. This is the way politics and policy are made.
Another amazing moment. You would think after starting a press conference with the Doral G7 announcement, you couldn't possibly top it. But Mulvaney did seem to do so by then in answer to reporters' questions. He essentially seemed to admit that, yes, of course, the president had engaged in a quid pro quo with Ukraine. And absolutely, not only had he engaged in a quid pro quo, but Mulvaney then went on to helpfully outline what the quid pro quo was and to say, actually, we wanted them to investigate an absurd, debunked conspiracy theory about the 2016 election in order to receive hundreds of millions of dollars in congressionally appropriated military aid. Again, how is this complicated for people? I would imagine Republicans and Democrats would be equally shocked and amazed by this fact set. Obviously, the reporters in the room were shocked. Jonathan Carl of ABC News, he said basically, did you just say what I think you said? And that's what elicited the response of, hey, you reporters, get over it. Of course, this is just how politics works. Well, this is not how foreign policy works. It's not how politics works. And even for the White House and the Justice Department, this was a bridge too far. People freaked out after the press conference. And sure enough, a few hours later, Mulvaney released a statement basically saying, you evil press, how did you misrepresent my words? Of course, I said, to be clear, there was absolutely no quid pro quo. Well, of course, it wasn't about representing anything. There's a tape of the press conference, and it's the man's own words that he's trying to walk back, not very convincingly.
You know, all of this seems to corroborate exactly what the whistleblower said right at the beginning.
Well, that's right, Diane. And I think that is the big picture takeaway for people. When this investigation began, it was only a little bit more than 3 weeks ago. I know it feels like an eternity, but it was only a little bit more than 3 weeks ago. What did we know at that time? We had two very amazing, but still only two pieces of public information. We had the transcript of the July 25th phone call between Donald Trump and the president of Ukraine, Zelensky, and we had the anonymous whistleblower's complaint, both of which suggested many of the facts that we've just been discussing. But what we've seen is that it's not only been corroborated in the investigation over the ensuing weeks, but it's become, I would say, even more clear how central to the plot the president himself was. In Watergate, as I understand it, right, like 2 years of investigation that was all around the question of what did President Nixon know and when did he know it? Well, here, actually, the president is at the very center of the actions being taken. Here he is telling the ambassador to the EU, Gordon Sondland, you get involved, telling the energy secretary, Ann Sondland, and Kurt Volker, his special envoy, you go through Rudy Giuliani. No, I'm not going to have a meeting with Zelensky until you talk to Giuliani. And Giuliani has these conditions that he's laying out, telling Zelensky in the phone call, talk to Giuliani and Barr, his attorney general, in the same sentence, personally firing the ambassador to Ukraine. That was not done by some government process. That was Trump personally ordering it to be done, personally ordering the withholding of the aid to Ukraine. The fact that it was Trump himself taking these actions is very significant. And the reason I bring it up as well is because you see some misrepresentation, even among Republicans who are critical of Trump or concerned about these events. I think they haven't paid enough attention yet, and they haven't really absorbed the fact that it's not about just a phone call or some words on a phone call. Do us a favor, though. That sounds really bad, but it's the sounding really bad combined with incredibly specific government actions that Trump took that's at the heart of this.
So what is the impeachable offense? Running a shadow government or trying to gain a quid pro quo on the telephone?
Well, I think there are almost certainly going to be multiple impeachable offenses that the House will look at. I don't know what they'll end up with or how they'll frame it. The broad heading here, of course, is abuse of power and especially distortion of the national interests in favor of your own personal interests. The specifics clearly abound to what appear to be quid pro quos, not one. There's a quid pro quo that was over and over again imposed upon the Ukrainians for the meeting between President Trump and President Zelensky. And that was made very explicit in the text messages and in the phone calls and in the personal meetings between these Trump envoys and Zelensky and his officials, that he could not meet with the president until he produced the, quote, deliverable. That's from one of the texts. So the deliverable appears to be the agreement to investigate both Burisma, which is the company that Joe Biden's son was a director of, and also this debunked 2016 conspiracy theory. So that's one quid pro quo. And then the other quid pro quo is the president's decision to withhold the military aid pending the agreement on the investigation.
Now a quick break. When we come back, more with Susan Glasser. Now, here's the rest of my conversation with Susan Glasser. She's a staff writer for The New Yorker. Mitch McConnell has already told Republicans to get ready for an impeachment. What does that mean? Is he telling them to simply vote no? What is he telling them?
Well, you know, it's a really it's a fraught situation, obviously, for the Senate Majority Leader, who has been Donald Trump's bulwark up on Capitol Hill. And as long as McConnell sticks with Trump, Trump seems very confident that he will win acquittal in a Senate trial. And there's no sign of McConnell doing anything other than sticking with Trump. In fact, he's actually been running campaign ads back in Kentucky, bragging that he's going to save Donald Trump from removal from office and in this impeachment trial. But the politics, of course, are more complicated than that, and they have to be worrisome to Republicans when you have a majority of Americans in public polls already saying that they support not only Trump's impeachment, but his removal from office. In a Wall Street Journal poll, there were 51% who were in favor of removal. In a Gallup poll the other day, there were 52%. That is higher than at any time in the Nixon-Watergate investigation up until 2 weeks before he was forced to leave office.
So explain to me why Republicans are willing, as did Lindsey Graham and others, why they're so willing to speak out about his policy regarding the Kurds in Syria, and why they are not willing to speak out on the Ukraine.
You know, Diane, it's hard to understand sometimes. I mean, the thing about thinking about Trump's Washington, right, is that Trump is constantly in the center of our minds, but in some ways is not all that complicated, right? You know, his personality is right out there for all of us to see. So he might do something that shocks or astonishes us, but, you know, we have a pretty clear read on his personality and what's driving him. But he has also served as an X-ray, I think, for those around him. And that's where you get more surprises. And the Republicans on Capitol Hill and their behavior when confronted with the dilemmas of Donald Trump taking over their party that part just sort of never ceases to confound and amaze me. So you do have probably the strongest criticism of Trump's presidency coming from Republicans right now on Capitol Hill about the Syria decision. At the very same moment, they're also holding meetings to defend him to the death on impeachment. These are Republicans, by the way, who are Russia hawks, who are out there sanctimoniously over and over again. And I can tell you, because I'm very interested in Russia and always follow this, for almost 3 years, I've been listening to these same people literally sanctimoniously blab on about how crucial our Ukraine policy is and how it's so much better than the Obama administration's because Donald Trump decided to send arms to Ukraine and to send Javelin anti-tank missiles to Ukraine and to stand up to Russian aggression. So who cares what Donald Trump says publicly about Vladimir Putin when it counts on the policy? You know, we are doing the right thing. These are the exact same people who've been saying that. And now they say when Donald Trump blew up that policy, they say never mind, because, of course, it's politically central to Trump's survival. Therefore, it's a test of loyalty, and they don't feel that they can break ranks. Whereas on Syria, they seem to feel that, A, the American public doesn't care all that much about foreign policy, and, B, that Trump has allowed a measure of dissent, because, of course, basically everybody disagrees with him, even inside his own administration. There are not big supporters of what he's just done, which is abandoning an American ally.
And in effect, handed Russia Syria.
Absolutely. He has given Russia another very significant geopolitical victory. Of course, this entire Ukraine scandal is a massive propaganda coup for Russia. The withdrawal and abandonment of our allies in Syria. You know, I speak Russian still a bit from our time there. Peter and I spent 4 years working for the Post in Russia, and I watched a video that is an extraordinary video of Russian troops and with some embedded Russian-speaking media racing to occupy the main American base in Syria that the U.S. hastily abandoned this week so quickly that there was still food left on the tables in the mess hall when the Russians came in. And, of course, they gleefully went and filmed every last bit of that base. The Americans, on Wednesday, when Donald Trump was falsely and absurdly claiming this is some, I think, strategically brilliant move was the phrase he used about his decision. On that very same day, American warplanes, F-15 fighter jets, were bombing another one of our bases to destroy it so it couldn't fall into the wrong hands. This was an American national humiliation, and no one who's listening to this today should be under any illusions. Republicans don't support this, and Democrats don't support this. Donald Trump is the only one who supports doing this in this way. And it has nothing to do with ending endless wars or getting American troops out of harm's way. These same troops are going to stay in the region. They're not coming back to the United States. They're staying in the Middle East.
And you should say your husband is Peter Baker of
the New York Times.
I want to ask you how much damage you think this Ukraine story has done to Joe Biden.
You know, it's a good question, Diane. I don't think we really can fully assess it yet. Obviously, this is a different political situation than it was in 2016. People are very wise to how Trump uses false equivalences. You know, I'm accused of corruption, so I'll accuse you of corruption. You know, it seems particularly eye-popping to be hammering on about Hunter and Joe Biden, as Trump has been doing when his own children are making literally tens of millions of dollars profiting off of his service in the White House. Ivanka Trump and Jared Kushner are on the White House staff at the same time they're making millions of dollars in deals around the world, which are an obvious, again, conflict of interest. So, you know, the flip side is, as journalists, we know we're able to walk and chew gum at the same time. We're able to, you know, make a hierarchy in our own heads. In my view, you can say that Hillary Clinton made misjudgments of a serious nature in how she handled her email when she was at the State Department, and also understand fundamentally that could be quite different than the egregious conflicts of interest we're seeing now in the White House. And so I think people are trying to understand what context they should put this in with Biden. But let's be real. I mean, Hunter Biden made, as he himself has acknowledged, a lapse in judgment in accepting this position. It put his father, at a minimum, in an awkward and embarrassing situation. Political families often find that they're embarrassing their, famous and powerful mother or father in doing things. And, you know, it's terrible. They shouldn't do that. Why were those companies paying Hunter Biden? I suspect it was because of his last name.
Of course. The question many people are asking, and perhaps you yourself have asked this question, would it be better to impeach and remove Donald Trump or simply vote him out of office?
You know, I think Democrats lost their way for a while on getting tied up in knots over this question. You know, the answer is that there's not an asterisk in the Constitution that says, when convenient, please make sure you carry out this responsibility. Some of the allegations against Trump are very, very serious. And I think that from a historical perspective, it would be very hard for Democrats to simply not look into them at all. And does that empower any future president, Democrat or Republican, to do some of the same things that are alleged by Trump? I mean, you know, this is a Congress that in your and my living memory impeached a president of the United States for lying under oath about a matter not related to his official duties. And, again, that's a very serious matter, by the way. I always felt at the time, again, outside of partisanship, that, of course, our president is our chief law enforcement officer, among many other responsibilities, and lying under oath in a court of law, no matter what the underlying subject matter, is a serious offense. It is nowhere near as serious as some of the allegations that are currently being investigated by Donald Trump. Again, allegations. That's what investigations are for. I think we don't know how the politics are going to play out in the short term. I think you see Democrats kind of relieved that a decision has been made and they're no longer having a debate, right? You know, at least, okay, we're doing something.
We can't leave this conversation without talking about the late Elijah Cummings. He was such an important voice throughout this country and an important voice in helping people to recognize how serious this situation is.
Well, that's right. There aren't that many leaders who have moral clarity at this moment in time. And of course, that's been one of the other, you know, when I call Trump an X-ray for other people's souls, right? Like, that's one of the other things you've seen, a notable absence of what we used to call, you know, elder statesmen or stateswomen speaking out. And so, you know, you're left with a different set of pictures. Obviously, Elijah Cummings was a partisan figure. He was a very active Democrat, and yet he had close friendships across the aisle in the way that used to happen. Mark Meadows, the founder of the Freedom Caucus, was really truly one of his best friends, and I take that at face value. And yet Cummings believed that he was, in investigating Trump, pursuing the restoration of the balance of powers that exists in our Constitution, and that I think has been one of the most striking aspects of the Trump presidency, is to take the notion of executive powers and to put it on steroids, to supersize it, to make assertions that are so sweeping about what a president can do without regard to Congress, as to make the presidency almost into that kingship that the founders feared. So Cummings, I saw it really on the leading edge of pushing back against that and restoring a definition of what Congress's meaningful role at the table should be.
Susan, do you believe that any Republicans, now that all of this has come to the fore, do you see any weakening in their overall support for Donald Trump, or even moving toward the idea of impeachment?
You know, the short answer is no, not in a very significant way. The slightly longer answer is there are likely to be some Republican members in both the House and the Senate who do vote for impeachment in the House and potentially for conviction in the Senate. The numbers will be small. It's hard to imagine that there will be 20 senators willing to convict Trump. And of course, the smaller the number of Republican House members who vote for impeachment, that will have some influence on the ultimate vote in the Senate as well. I do think privately members are under no illusion about what is Donald Trump, and many of them would just as soon not have had him take over their party. But there are not many profiles in Courage who are willing to speak publicly in the way they speak privately about Donald Trump.
So what's the long-term implication of going through that process and having conviction defeated?
Well, that's something that I think we're all just beginning to wrap our brains around. And, you know, there's some real worst case scenarios for Democrats there, both politically in terms of the 2020 election, and then also in terms of the longer term constitutional balance of powers. First of all, you know, will the Senate take it all the way through to an actual acquittal in a trial? If so, does that give Trump even more ability to crow on the campaign trail that he's been utterly vindicated? You know, would in that sense, would it be better for those few Republicans who are opposed to Trump to negotiate some kind of an outcome other than a full-blown acquittal? Because, it, you know, better to dismiss the trial with prejudice than to, or censure him or something, than it would be to have him be acquitted. I don't know. But I think people in Washington are just beginning to, you know, kind of talk through and game out these scenarios.
Susan Glasser, as always, thank you.
Diane, it's wonderful to be with you.
And that's all for today. Find us on Facebook and Twitter, or send us an email, drpodcast@wamu.org. Our theme music is composed by Jim Brunberg and Ben Landsberg of Wonderly. Our engineers this week are Josephine Neonai and Natalie Yurev-Lipker. The show is produced by Rebecca Kaufman and Allison Brody. Thanks for listening, all. I'm Diane Rehm.